allow us to overcome some of our greatest obstacles. And oftentimes in the church, we have this idea of what a family is, and it isn't necessarily exactly what winds up being true in your life. It's not always the way that we paint it, is it? It doesn't always end up looking like the quote-unquote ideal family. So where do we get this idea of an ideal family? Well, we actually have our perception of what the ideal family is mostly due to the 1950s. In the 1950s, everything was painted so perfectly, right? It was during this time that the idea of a nuclear family was developed. So you have your mom, your dad, your brother or brothers, and sister or sisters, and that's your nuclear family. That is the family that you live with under one household, and everything is perfect, and you eat dinner together, and you have fun together, and all of that good stuff. Now, this developed out of a socioeconomic time of prosperity. It was a time where we could live as smaller units of families, where the stability of these smaller systems was actually possible because of the amount of money that was coming in, the amount of incomes were going up. And so what we thought of as a family began to change, began to grow. And during the 1950s, it actually began to be turned into a sort of a medium for propaganda, if you will. The leaders of the country began to put out this idea of what a perfect family looks like and what you're supposed to look like in your family. So we're going to take I took a little laugh at this. You may appreciate it. It's a little funny. So let's take a look at what the ideal family was portrayed as in the 1950s. Possibly. Okay, last chance. Okay, so y'all don't get to see the ideal family. But essentially what this video portrayed was a family that was, you know, they were out at a dinner time that everybody prepared themselves accordingly. The mom prepared herself, and it said that the ideal woman should be prepared, should be dressed accordingly for whenever the man arrives for dinner. The dinner should be prepared accordingly, and she should have a relaxed attitude about her because she owes it to her husband to not have any tension. And as mom gets ready and she goes on, daughter comes into the kitchen and she helps mom accordingly. And they have a wonderful time cooking and preparing dinner and setting up the dinner table. And as they're doing that, big brother goes and he helps little brother get ready for dinner. And they wipe off his face from the baseball game that he went to earlier. And they enjoy some little wrestling and playing around. And they get ready for dinner. But they must be ready for dinner on time, because it is very imperative that they are punctual. So dad arrives home, and they have an opportunity as the males of the family to sit down and talk a little bit about their day while the females finish setting up the table and preparing dinner. Then afterwards, they all sit down to a wonderful meal, and as the video says, they avoid any extremely emotional topics, because that would be inconsiderate to father, as he's had a long day at work. And they try to talk about things that are nice. This all culminates in a very perfect, ideal family meal, right? This all culminates in a very perfect, ideal way of living for people in the 1950s. But for some of you who may have lived during the 1950s, that wasn't the whole story, was it? There was a lot more than just that ideal family going on behind the scenes. It was during the 1950s that Elvis Presley got on the scene and started shaking his hips and making a lot of people mad, right? It was during the 1950s that the civil rights movement began to gain steam, and there was a lot of violence, there was a lot of unrest, there was segregation, there was integration, or at least attempts at it. It was during the 1950s that all of these things were going on behind the scenes, yet there was an ideal family. Yet, there was a way to live happily ever after and have the perfect family. For families today, a lot of things have changed, haven't they? As we saw, it wasn't actually perfect during the 1950s, but regardless, things have evolved, things have changed over time in the family. We see that even before the 1950s, before the 1800s, that families actually were more like clans of people. So what we call extended family, all of your cousins, all of your grandparents, they would be living in a community. And that would be a clan of over 40 people, and you would all live together. And you would all help take care of each other. Then you fast forward to the Wild Wild West, and the family started to get a little bit smaller. At that point, we had about an average of 20 people in a group, in a system, if you will, that helped take care of each other. They helped to watch over each other. By 1850, the average had plummeted down to 10 people in your average system. And then by 2000, the average went down to less than 3. Not to mention, there were 27% of the population actually living alone, without a family. But the interesting part to all of that is we have seemed to come full circle. Because as the average number whittled down, the system, the community that you rely on, began to grow larger. So although the home might be you living by yourself, you rely on your friends that you know from work. You rely more on the people that you see on a regular basis. And instead of only being with your nuclear family, people are beginning to rely on a broader scope of people. They're beginning to have more people as part of their family system. Single moms and dads nowadays They don't just do it on their own. They have support of a clan. There's been a significant increase in nursing home age citizens, but yet the nursing home population has actually gone down. That tells us that more people are willing to appreciate the elderly, keep them in their homes, keep them closer. And so we're beginning to see the circle close in, and we're coming back to a time where we want more people in our system. We want grandma and grandpa still around. We want to be supported by a wider group of people because it offers a little more stability. It offers a little more ability to survive the storms in life. So what does the Bible tell us about families? What are some families that we see in the Bible? Well, the first family that we see is obviously Adam and Eve, right? And they had a wonderful family, didn't they? Or did they? Well, the first family, we see that the wifey was a little bit of a trickster. She tricked her husband into disobeying God. And then things got really bad whenever one of their sons committed murder against the other one. So not only do you have some distrust in the parental unit, but you have some domestic violence amongst the kids. What is up with that? But then you have Noah's family, right? Noah and his family were the only ones that were chosen to be saved from the flood, so of course they're going to be the good family, right? Noah saved his family from the flood, but then he got a little crazy. Maybe had a little bit too much to drink. And, you know, I don't blame him. Maybe sailing around for that long might have made him a little restless. But nonetheless, you continue reading the story of Noah and his family, and there were some really weird things that happened after they got off of that boat. He ended up cursing his son for some stuff that went on in the tent. And the story goes on, and we have yet another example of a somewhat dysfunctional family. And then you have Lot's family. Read about Lot's family, because that one gets really weird. That one, for sure, might throw you for a loop. Solomon's family, of course, the smartest guy on the planet, right? He was the wisest man. But he also had a palace full of wives. Need I say more? He, among all the people, was led astray by his non-believing spouses. So he himself had a pretty dysfunctional family going on. And of course, we can count on Jesus and his family, right? Well, even Jesus' family had some issues. I wouldn't say that his parents would have gotten the parental award of the year. Because if you remember, there was a point in time where they had gone on a trip and somehow they forgot where Jesus, the Son of God, was and had to circle back around to find him at the temple. And then you have Paul and his family. But for some reason, as Paul describes it, maybe he wasn't too thrilled by the idea of having a family. He, for some reason, appreciated the idea of not being tied down to a family. So as I started out, I said these systems, these families that we're a part of, they can offer strength and stability. Yet in the Bible, these families are offering what? Chaos, destruction, straying from God. So what can we learn from the Bible when it comes to a family? What can we learn about what our family should look like whenever we are trying to raise a family? Whenever we are trying to be good people? How in the world are we supposed to survive these storms that are thrown at us through our lives? Especially when we have a bunch of little ones relying on us to maintain our sanity. With all of our sins and all the troubles of this world, it seems truly impossible to stay close to God at times. But we see here that Paul gives us a great understanding of what it truly takes. After answering a bunch of difficult questions in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul is talking, has just finished answering some questions about marriage, divorce, remarriage. He's been asked questions about what does a family look like? How in the world are we supposed to know what a good family, what an ideal family is supposed to do? So starting in verse 29, he says, "But this I say, brethren, the time has been shortened, so that from now on those who have wives should be as though they had none, and those who weep as though they did not weep, and those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, and those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it. For the form of this world is passing away, but I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord. How he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. And the woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I say for your own benefit." Stop there for a second, because he just finished answering all these questions about marriage, about divorce, about remarriage, and then he seems to kind of throw it all out the window, doesn't he? He seems to kind of try to reorient. Because now he's saying, you know, first of all, wherever you are, whatever situation you're in, whenever you come to God, stay there. And then he gives the reasons why it's so good to not be married. But for us, is he telling us that we shouldn't be married? Is he telling us that the perfect family is to not have a family at all? I'd hope not, because we have quite a few families here, don't we? Quite a few men who have made that leap of faith and asked for that special loved one to marry them and spend the rest of their life with them. So what is Paul getting at? Continuing on in verse 35, he tells us what is for our own benefit. He says, not to put a restraint upon you. So in other words, listen, I'm not restraining you to this. But what he is trying to do is to promote what is seemly and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. That is what Paul's concerned with. That is what makes an ideal family. Paul wants us to be undistracted, to have an absolute devotion to our Lord and Savior. Paul warns that despite the distractions of family, consecration of your own heart is the key to living for God, is the key to having the ideal family. Utter devotion with all of your heart. We went through a list of pretty dysfunctional families in the Old Testament and the New. And there's plenty of other families and examples throughout the Bible. But the ones that survived the storms, the ones that stayed close to God, had somebody leading them, had people in their family who were utterly and absolutely devoted to God. Their hearts were focused on God. In the midst of their adversity, they saw God. They knew God. And they held on to a belief system that allowed them to trust in God. And it is in this belief system that we can find strength, that we find purpose as a family, as an individual. So in this, McGoldrick is her name, and she talks about resilient families, what it takes to have a resilient family. And there are 9 things that showed up in the studies that she looked at, in the study that she had, of what makes a resilient family. Now, there's 9 of them, and I would encourage you to, maybe if you're taking notes, write down these 9 key processes of resilient family, because they are good things to know, they're good things to be aware of. Because we have them kind of broken down into the first 3 you see as a belief system. We see that resilient families make meaning of adversity. They have a positive outlook on life. They have a transcendence and a spirituality about them. The next 3 you'll notice are some sort of organizational patterns. They have flexibility, connectedness. They have social and economic resources. And then the last 3 pertain to communication and problem solving. Families that are resilient have clear and consistent messages. They have open emotional expression. And they develop collaborative problem solving. As I said, these are all good things for you to think about and consider in terms of your family. But the 3 that we will be focusing on over the next few weeks pertain to the belief system. Because that's what we have in God. That's what we hold true whenever we are in those storms of life. Whenever you're not sure how you're going to pay the water bill. Whenever you're not sure whether or not you're going to survive this new illness. Whenever you're not sure if your marriage is going to last. Whenever life throws you uncertainty, we rely on our belief system in God. and trust that he will carry us through. And how do we do that as a family? Over the next few weeks, we're going to be talking about that. Because research suggests that families with a belief system are very resilient. They can make it through a lot of things. Families that believe in God can make it through anything. There's this belief system that we have in Christianity that offers us strength, that offers us peace. Whenever you're faced with even the most difficult of obstacles, you know that it is this belief system that will offer meaning in your adversities. It is this belief system that allows you to have a positive outlook on what is going on in your life. It is a belief in Jesus Christ that allows you to transcend all of the problems that are going on a daily basis. That, and only that, will allow you to overcome. As Jesus says in the book of Revelation, whenever we read of the most extreme examples of families going through turmoil and struggle, you will overcome because I have overcome. Jesus Christ has won the battle. They've won the war, and we have no more to worry about. But we do need to make sure that as individuals and as families, our belief system is intact and that it is focused on the cross, because through that, we can overcome anything. If you feel like you're in a storm today, if your family is hurting, if you are hurting, we're here for you. If you need prayer, if you need help, if you need anything, we're here for you. Because that's exactly what families are for. And even if your family is going through a world of hurt right now, this family is here for you. So let us know if you have a need as we stand and sing.
Softly and tenderly Jesus is calling, calling for you and for me. See on the portal his way.